The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Discussing the philosophy of the 17th and 18th centuries. Talked a little bit about continental rationalism last time. We spent about 5 minutes on that, and now we'll spend about 5 minutes on British empiricism today. Point to remember about rationalism, of course, is that they regard reason as the way to knowledge. They're impressed with the fact that sense experience is very often confused, that one person will sense things in a very different way from someone else. To some, the room is hot. To someone else, the room is cold. We see the stick in the water, and even though it's straight, we know it's straight. We see it as bent, so our senses mislead us. Our senses are not a dependable road to knowledge. We cannot be sure of anything until we have put it through the apparatus of the mind, until we have analyzed it with the reason, because it's the reason that has the ability to correct the misapprehensions of sense experience. It's the reason, then, which is the way to achieve truth. The way to achieve truth is to determine those ideas in the mind of which there can be no doubt. And that, of course, is the way Descartes proceeds. He proceeds not by examining the data of his senses. He begins by examining the ideas of his mind. Good question is, what's the difference? Well, hang on to that. By examining the ideas of his mind and asking if he can find an idea of which there can be no doubt, and focusing on then on his own nature, his own self-consciousness as a thinking being, he tries to deduce all the rest of the fabric of knowledge from that insight. Now, the empiricists take the opposite approach. The empiricists, of course, are Britishers. The principal empiricists are Britishers. John Locke, Bishop Berkeley, as the English say, Berkeley is what Dr. Van Til used to say. I'll take either pronunciation from you. David Hume, then the latest of the three, writing in the middle 1700s. The rationalists, of course, dominated the continent of Europe, and the empiricists dominated Great Britain, and it's been pretty much that way since the time of William of Ockham, off and on. But in British empiricism, you have a different approach. The British empiricists are primarily aware of the limitations of reason and of the positive aspects of sense experience. The British empiricists are aware that if you allow your reason to run wild without grounding it in experience, without grounding it in the experience of your senses, then, of course, you're going to be in trouble. You're going to wind up speculating about all kinds of things that you really don't know anything about. And, of course, these British philosophers felt that the continental rationalists engaged in all kinds of speculation, that their minds went off on all kinds of wild tacks. They started speculating about things that they really had no experience of and could not make any meaningful judgments about. So, according to the empiricists, all knowledge begins with sense experience, and the reason must always be grounded in any rational conclusions that we reach must always be based upon the impressions of our senses. Any idea that we have has to be traced back to some sensation. It has to be traced back to some impression. It has to be traced back to something that we've seen or heard or touched or felt. And unless you can trace your ideas back to some kind of experience, then you really have no basis for asserting them at all. All right, On this empiricist basis, John Locke comes up with basically, I guess you might say, a fairly common sense philosophy. We have minds and there are objects out there, and the world is pretty much the way it looks. that's kind of unusual for a philosopher to maintain that, but that's sort of the way Locke reasoned. Berkeley, however, could not restrain his philosophical inclinations. Berkeley reasoned sort of in this way. He said, look, we have all these experiences. We have experiences of trees. We have experiences of chairs. We have experiences of buildings and people. Now, of course, we have to begin with experiences. That's the good old empirical principle. Now, can we reason from these experiences to something corresponding to the experiences? In other words, I have an experience of a tree. I have an impression of a tree. Now, can I reason from that impression back to the real tree? Can I say that just because I have an impression of the tree, there must be a real tree, a material tree out there somewhere that corresponds to my impression, that corresponds to my experience? And Berkeley's answer, surprisingly, was no. All we know is our experiences. We don't know of anything corresponding to the experiences. And when you start reasoning about things that correspond, when you start reasoning about material objects, when you start reasoning about real trees and real chairs and real buildings, you're going beyond your experience. You're going beyond anything that you can make assertions about. So Berkeley rejected the notion of a material substance. He rejected the notion of a material substance. All we have are experiences. All we perceive are our own perceptions. All we experience are our own experiences. We don't experience objects. We don't experience material substances. All we experience are experiences. All we perceive are perceptions. Berkeley went on from there and argued that he has gained some knowledge now about what reality is like, because perceptions exist in a mind, right? Experiences are things that can be had by a mind. It's the mind that has experiences. And so Berkeley argued that all of reality was basically mental in character, that all of reality was in some mind or other. This makes Berkeley an idealist. Remember, we talked about Leibniz as a rationalistic idealist. Well, Berkeley is an empiricist idealist. Berkeley believes that all reality is in some mind or other. Now, how can we... does this mean then that trees disappear when nobody's perceiving them? Does that mean that there's no tree in the forest unless there's some human being there to perceive the tree? Well, no, says Berkeley, because in order to maintain the continuity of experience, in order to maintain the rationality of the world, in order to maintain the connections between things, you have to posit a gigantic mind, a mind that has all of these ideas in it all the time. And that gigantic mind, of course, is God. Berkeley is a bishop of the church, and he's using this as a means of apologetic, then, to show that God exists and that God has to be assumed if we're going to have an intelligible understanding of reality. Now, David Hume comes along, and David Hume is even more radical than Berkeley is. David Hume begins at the same point. He maintains that all we really perceive are perceptions. It sounds tautological, but there's a lot of assumptions in that. Hume insists that we perceive only our perceptions. He maintains that there are, with Berkeley, that you can't identify substances out in the world. But he goes somewhat beyond Berkeley. Berkeley, of course, believed that there were minds. Berkeley rejected the idea of a material substance, but Berkeley did hold to the idea of a mental substance. Berkeley felt that there really were minds, there really were souls that held all of these perceptions together, that held all of these experiences together. Now Hume becomes skeptical even of that, because Hume reasons this way. You look out in the world, now what do you see? What do you hear? Well, you see trees, you see chairs, you see people. Do you see a mind? Do you see anything that has these perceptions? No, all you see is the perceptions. I don't see my mind out there. I don't have any experience of a mind. All I have experience of are people and colors and shapes and doors and windows and various things. I don't see any mind that somehow binds these things together. So just as Berkeley rejected the material substance, so Hume rejects the mental substance. Hume argues that there is no soul that holds all of these things together. Rather, he simply defined the human self as a bundle of perceptions. The human self is purely and simply a bundle of perceptions, an aggregate of perceptions. Hume also was skeptical about the notion of causality, about the notion of causality. For instance, we watch a billiard game and we see the one fellow bang one ball against another, and we say, well, this first motion was the cause of the second motion. Well, analyze that notion of cause a little bit. Analyze that notion of causality. Seems that when we look at that first ball moving along, that it has a kind of power in it. That power sort of forces the other ball to move. That there's some kind of necessity in that. The second motion is inevitable once you have the first motion. That the first motion necessitates the second one. That there's a necessary connection between the first one and the second one. But now Hume says, look at the situation a little more carefully. Now look at this a little more carefully. Do you really see that necessary connection between the one event and the other event? Well, what do you see? Well, you see one ball moving, and then you see the other ball moving. Do you see any you know, ghostly force moving from the one to the other? No. Do you see anything that you could hang the label necessity on? No. All you see is the one thing happening and then the other thing happening. Well, you know, the one thing comes before the other. The one thing is conjoined to the other. Hume asks, how do you get the idea of causality? And how do you get the idea that every effect has a cause? How do you get the idea that there's a necessary connection between cause and effect? It's not through your sense perceptions. It's a kind of habit, he says. It's a kind of custom that we develop. You know, over and over again, we see the same combination. We see this motion and then this motion. And we get so that we kind of expect the second one to happen when we see the first. We get into the habit of expecting the second to take place after the first has taken place. But it's not something that, you know, is absolutely inevitable in the nature of things. We don't know the nature of things. We just get into the habit of seeing things in a certain way. Now, Hume says it's a good habit. We shouldn't get out of that habit. And Hume doesn't want us to think that, you know, any effects are causeless. He doesn't want to break down the fabric of science that way. In fact, he has a very he has a very elaborate theory of probability, by which he rules out, incidentally, the possibility of miracle. He argues that reality is so structured that any evidence for a miracle, any evidence that you may have for a miracle, is automatically overruled by all the evidence which suggests that there are no miracles. Our general experience suggests that there can't be any miracles. Our general experience suggests that you can't rise from the dead. Our general experience suggests that water cannot turn into wine. Our general experience suggests that nobody can walk on water. And so when somebody comes and brings some evidence that somebody somewhere has turned water into wine and somebody somewhere has walked on the water, well, sort of scratch our heads and say, well, now that fellow, you know, it's kind of hard to depend on people. They make up stories. They misunderstand things. Certainly this fellow's testimony can't count against all the impressive weight of evidence on the other side. So Hume really did believe, you see, that we ought to trust our habits. He believed that we ought to trust our customs. He believed that this habit of connecting causes with effects is something that ought to be jealously maintained, even to the point of ruling out the possibility of miracles occurring. But nevertheless, he had to admit that this was a habit. It was a custom. It's not something that you can, you can't prove that every effect has a cause. You don't perceive some necessary connection between causes and effects. You're just shut up to carrying on the habits and customs with which you have been trained. Now, we come to the next figure, who is probably the most important figure in the history of modern philosophy. Sutton, Pascal? Well, I really don't have much time to talk about Pascal. He he's basically a 17th century thinker, but he's in a totally rather different orientation. He's more of a theological thinker, I guess, in a way than a philosopher. He takes after Augustine in a lot of areas. He's sympathetic with the Jansenists, who represent a reformational emphasis within the Catholic Church, a kind of Augustinian emphasis within the Catholic Church at the time, and very much against the Jansenists, engages in various arguments on behalf of miracles and whatnot. And well, it depends on what you mean by causality. If by causality you are referring to some necessary connection, some necessary force that moves from one object to another, you could say that Hume is either denying that, or that he's simply, or that he's denying that we have any knowledge of it if it exists. But if you're willing to define causality in a more limited kind of way, if it's just a sort of habit that we get into, then Hume is saying that there is causality and that it can be established and that it does rest on a foundation. I'm sorry, I really, we're so pressed for time that I'd rather not take up this class and discussion. If you will, bring up your questions in the discussion groups and if you want to talk to me outside of class, I'd be happy to do that. Now let's move on to Immanuel Kant, who's probably the most important philosopher of the modern period, probably the most important philosopher since Thomas Aquinas. The influence of Kant upon contemporary theology is just overwhelming. Most all contemporary theology takes its point of departure from Immanuel Kant, and most all of the distinctions that you find in Kant get conjugated into modern theology in one way or another. So we ought to spend some time on Kant. Hermann Duyverd, I mentioned earlier, distinguishes between three different types of thinking that have occurred in the Western, in the history of Western thought. He distinguishes the form-matter scheme, which he believes is characteristic of the Greek period, and then the so-called nature-grace scheme, which is characteristic of medieval Christian thought. This is where you take the Greek form-matter scheme and you add to it a further dimension of reality that's supplied by revelation. So you see revelation as a supplement to this basic natural structure which was developed by Plato and Aristotle. In the modern period, Duyverd sees modern thinking as dominated by a third motif, the so-called nature-freedom motif. And this nature-freedom motif he sees to originate in the thought of Immanuel Kant. So keep in mind, I may not use that terminology very much, but keep in mind when I talk about Kant, this is what Duyverd means when he talks about the nature-freedom scheme. Now, Kant was trained in philosophy in the tradition of continental rationalism, that is the tradition of such thinkers as Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz, and particularly another rationalist by the name of Wolff, W-O-L-F-F. Now, having gone through all that, Kant began to read a philosopher who was not too widely read in Europe at that time, namely David Hume. And reading David Hume, says Kant, awakened him from his dogmatic slumbers. Kant began to realize when he read David Hume how limited the reason is, how limited the capabilities of reason really are. And he came to agree with Hume on the following kinds of points. He agreed with Hume, first of all, that all knowledge must find some basis in sensation, that all knowledge must have some basis in experience. Secondly, he agreed with Hume that on the basis of experience alone, you cannot establish that there really are material substances, or that there really are mental substances, or that there really are causal powers in the real world. He maintained Hume's skepticism on that basis. You cannot prove through reason, you cannot prove through sense experience that the soul or the material object or the causal structure actually obtain in the real world. Nevertheless, having gotten that far, Kant was not content. Kant was not willing to let it lie at that point, because Kant felt that if you stick with Hume's approach, you place science and mathematics in jeopardy. You place science and mathematics in jeopardy. In other words, if causality is based on a mere habit, if our conviction about causality is based on a mere custom, then it would seem that anything can happen. It would seem that there's really no basis for assuming that a scientific investigation can establish the relations of things. There seems to be no basis for predicting. There seems to be no basis for making judgments of what's going to happen. So Kant now wants to go beyond Hume and to bring in some of the elements of the older rationalism. But he can't do it in quite the way they did. It has to be a new structure. So here comes the new structure. It's Kant makes this famous distinction, which was to have a great amount of influence over philosophy and over theology, the distinction between the phenomenal and the noumenal. And those terms are spelled on the board. The distinction between the phenomenal and the noumenal. Now, the phenomenal world is the world that as it appears to us. The phenomenal world is the world as it appears to us. The phenomenal world is the world of our experience. The noumenal world is the world as it really is. All right? The noumenal world is the world as it really is, really in truth, apart from our experience, apart from any of our conceptualizations, the world as it really is. Now, says Kant, we have no guarantee that these two worlds are the same. There's no guarantee that these two worlds are the same. No guarantee that the world of our experience is the world as it really is. The two might be very, very different from one another. Now, they might also be the same, you know, that's a, that's a possibility in Kant's philosophy. Kant's philosophy, you know, can operate on that assumption, although in some of his writings he gives us reasons why we shouldn't make that assumption. But they could be the same. On the other hand, they might not be. We just don't know. See, he argues that we just don't know the world as it really is. We know only the world of our experience. We know only the world of phenomena. We know only the world as it appears to us. Now, you see, in speaking of phenomena, then, Kant, in speaking of the limitations of knowledge, Kant is very much on empirical ground. Nevertheless, the world of phenomena, the world of appearances, can be investigated by reason. It can be understood by reason. It can be thoroughly understood by reason. In the phenomenal world, reason has full sway. Now, why is this? Is it because our reason is so capable? Is it because there's such a that it has such enormous power? No, not really. The reason why reason can operate freely within the phenomenal world is because the reason itself, human reason, contributes the structure of that world. The structure of the phenomenal world is a product of human reason. The structure of the phenomenal world is a product of human thought. Now, that's a very bold kind of step, and that's the step that Kant is most famous for. It's not entirely new. Of course, philosophers before Kant have emphasized the influence of the mind upon our knowledge. The so-called active intellect of Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas has some resemblance to this notion of the mind contributing structure to reality. And in fact, there are some scholars now who are even suggesting that maybe we ought to interpret Thomas Aquinas more along Kantian lines. That's a matter for the scholars to resolve. But anyway, this type of thinking is most generally associated today with Kant. Kant is considered to be the one who brought this notion into the mainstream of contemporary philosophy. That the human reason actually creates the structure of experience. Now you can understand this a little bit if you think of various illustrations. Gordon Clark, I think, has a nice illustration about a bunch of intelligent jelly jars that are sitting on a shelf. And these intelligent jelly jars are philosophers, and they discuss the question of, you know, why is it that the jelly always takes the same shape, you know? and they study the jelly, you know, they make a microscopic examination of the chemical properties of the jelly, and there doesn't seem to be anything in the jelly that makes it take that shape, you know? And these intelligent jelly jars are philosophers, and they discuss the question of, you know, why is it that the jelly always takes the same shape, you know? and they study the jelly, you know, they make a microscopic examination of the chemical properties of the jelly, and there doesn't seem to be anything in the jelly that makes it take that shape, you know? And they think and think and think and think, and then suddenly one of them comes up with a bright idea. You know, maybe the jelly takes that shape not because of something in the jelly, but because of something in us. Okay? Maybe the jelly is fitting into the jar because of the shape of the jar. Okay? That's why it has the structure it has. And so you can sort of think of it along those lines. You can think of Van Til likes to talk about ice cube trays. You know, why is it the water takes the shape of the tray? Well, it's not because of some mysterious property in the water, it's because of the shape of the tray. So Kant looks at it sort of that way. So when you ask Hume's question, why is it that we have this idea of causality? Why is it that we have this notion that every effect has a cause, or that every event has a cause even? Why is it that we make that assumption? Well, you know, we don't know whether there's any real causality in the real world. We don't know if there's any such thing in the so-called noumenal world. Hume is right there. We don't know whether there's anything out in the real world. But we still have to assert very, very clearly and dogmatically that every effect has a cause, because that's the way we think. Okay? That's human nature, to think that way. The mind cannot think any other way except in terms of cause and effect. The mind can't think of any other way except in terms of substances, material substance and mental substance. That we have to think this way in order to reason, in order to carry out our work. So Kant then argues that the whole structure of our experience, the form of our experience, to use the Platonic or Aristotelian language, the form, the structure, the meaning of experience is furnished by the mind. It is the way it is because our minds are the way they are. Now, of course, then, reason has full competence within the realm of the phenomena. Of course, reason can have exhaustive knowledge of the phenomena. Of course, reason is fully competent, because when reason applies itself to phenomena, it is merely thinking through its own structure. It is, if you will, to use the Aristotelian phrase, it's sort of like Aristotle's God. It's thought thinking itself. It's thought considering its own structure. It's thought considering its own nature. So, of course, the mind is capable of fully understanding the phenomenal world. You can then take a rationalistic attitude toward the phenomenal world. You can do to the phenomenal world about what Descartes and Spinoza and Leibniz were trying to do to it. They may have made mistakes, but their general project is sound as long as it's confined to the phenomenal world. As long as you don't try to claim that your investigation is true to reality as it really is. All right. Now, this structure sort of turns Greek philosophy on its head. You remember that according to Plato, the world of our experience is a world that's very difficult to know anything certain about. It's a world of opinion. It's a world where we have no certain knowledge. If we're going to find something that's really and truly knowable, we have to go to the world of forms. We have to abandon the world of our present experience and go to the world of forms. Now, Kant, you see, argues precisely the other way. It's this world here where we have a chance for full and complete and certain and sure knowledge. The world beyond our experience is unknowable. The world beyond our experience is unintelligible, because the only intelligibility that exists in the world is that intelligibility which we contribute. It's that intelligibility which we bring to it. There is no structure to the noumenal world, because the only structure you can talk about is the structure which your own mind supplies, and that structure is the structure which applies to the phenomenal world. Now, what does this do with respect to God? Well, Kant argued that you cannot prove God's existence. He developed arguments against all the traditional theistic proofs. He rejected the ontological, cosmological, and though he was somewhat impressed with the teleological argument, he finally wound up rejecting that one too. So you cannot prove God's existence. You can't establish that he exists. Why? Well, because when you try to prove God's existence, you're trying to reason from experience to something beyond experience. And that, in Kant's view, is wrong. You cannot derive any conclusions about something that's beyond the range of possible experience. You can reason only about things within your experience. Kant, well, okay, so you say, all right, you can't prove the existence of God. Is it possible that we can know God by revelation? Is it possible that we can know God through God speaking to us? Well, Kant really ruled that out too, because he argued that within the phenomenal world, all knowledge, all purported revelations, all claims to knowledge, all claims to truth must be judged by the rational understanding, all right? Any claim to truth, any claim to knowledge must be judged by the rational understanding. So if God tries to speak to us, if God tries to say something to us, that revelation cannot be absolutely authoritative. That revelation may not be accepted without question. That revelation has to be questioned by the rational mind. That revelation has to be evaluated by the human mind thinking apart from revelation. So the mind then is autonomous, and anything that God says to us has to be evaluated by the autonomous mind, which means that God cannot speak authoritatively. It's impossible for God to speak authoritatively. God is imprisoned in the noumenal world. God cannot come in to the world of phenomena. God is out here. In this realm where there is no structure, where there is no certain knowledge, if he exists at all, he exists out there, and there's no way that we can have any certain knowledge of him. There's no way that he can reveal his will to us infallibly. Furthermore, you can't know for sure that there is any world with an overall structure to it, that there is any such thing as a unified world. Even that, you see, to make that kind of statement would be to go beyond your experience. Nor do you know that there is such a thing as a self, as a human self, which gathers all of these experiences together in a unity. God, the world, the self, all of these things are relegated to the noumenal world. You don't know for sure whether they exist, but you simply confine your knowledge, the process of your reasoning, to the world that you're familiar with. Now, on this basis then, a little bit more on this. Nevertheless, Kant argues that we ought to act as if the noumenal world had a certain structure. Now, you don't know that there's a God, and if you try to prove that there's a God, you get mixed up in all kinds of problems. If you try to prove the world has a beginning, you can prove that it has a beginning, and you can prove that it doesn't have a beginning with just equal plausibility, because this is all beyond experience. But, nevertheless, it's awfully important that you act as if God exists. In order to, for one thing, in order to maintain your confidence in the uniformity of nature, a scientist, of course, has to have confidence in the uniformity of nature, and so he has to act as if there were an intelligent creator who had a wise plan and governs all things according to that wise plan. You don't know whether there really is such a thing, but you ought to act as if that's the case in order to preserve a proper scientific method. Furthermore, for the sake of morality, you ought to assume that God exists, because if you assume that God doesn't exist, then there's no basis for moral obligation. There's no punishment for the wicked. There's no reward for the righteous. There's no guarantee of responsibility. So you have to assume, then, that God exists in order to maintain a proper view of morality. Similarly, this, by the way, is Kant's so-called moral argument for God. Now, sometimes you'll read that Kant rejected all the other arguments, but he did hold to a kind of moral argument, namely that you need a God in order to maintain the moral order. Now, remember that this moral argument is something very different from the other kinds of arguments. The moral argument does not prove that there really is a God. The moral argument is basically an argument that we ought to behave as if God exists. We ought to live on the assumption that God exists. So the concept of God, then, in Kant's terminology, is not a constitutive concept, but it's a regulative concept. See that distinction? It's not constitutive. A constitutive concept is a concept that really corresponds to reality in some way. A regulative concept is one which may or may not designate something in the real world, but nevertheless is useful for regulating conduct. It's important to assume that such and such is the case in order to regulate your conduct. Furthermore, Kant argues that it's important for us to presuppose human freedom. Human freedom. Now, so far as the phenomenal world is concerned, it would seem that there is no human freedom, right? Because every effect has a cause, everything appears to be determined, everything can be explained in terms of the phenomenal structure. But you see, Kant now has discovered a way to allow for human freedom. That although you can't find any freedom in the phenomenal world, and although you can't prove that any freedom exists, nevertheless, it may still be true. It's possible that man is really free. It's possible that man is really autonomous. And, says Kant, It's important to act as if man is really free for purposes of morality. It's important to assume that man is utterly autonomous, that man is his own judge as to what is right and wrong, that man is the one who legislates morality for the whole world. He really does, almost ascribe divine attributes to man when he talks about the autonomous moral self. But remember, this is not something that we know is the case. This is simply a regulative concept. It's a way that we should behave, and we should act as if then there is freedom. Well, that's the sort of argument that lies behind Duivierd's phrase when he says that this is a nature freedom scheme. You see, the realm of phenomena then would be the realm of nature. It's a rather different kind of nature from what you had before. It's a nature which, in effect, is created by man's mind, which is rather different from Aristotle's concept of nature or Thomas Aquinas's concept of nature. But added to this somewhat different form of nature is this concept of freedom, the autonomous self, which in the noumenal world is free of all structure, is able to thus make its own autonomous decisions free of any constraint at all. So the humanist personality ideal has full sway in that realm, although it's very strictly limited when you're speaking of reason and when you're speaking of science. Well, Kant feels he's achieved two things. He's achieved a solid basis for mathematics and science. A solid basis for mathematics and science. When you're examining the phenomenal world, you can count on the laws of mathematics and the laws of physics. They're not going to have exceptions. You can trust that you can predict what's going to happen. You can analyze the phenomenal world fully and completely. So math and science rest on a firm basis. Secondly, there's also a basis for freedom, morality, religion. It's often been said that Kant limits reason in order to make room for faith. Kant gives free rein to faith. Kant argues that knowing God is not a matter of proving his existence, it's a matter of faith. And so at times Kant has even been called the philosopher of Protestantism. Because, as you know, all these Roman Catholics were preoccupied by rational proofs and demonstrations, trying to show that there really is a God. Kant says, no, I don't want any of that. Justification is by faith alone. Sounds sort of like Luther, doesn't he? Kant then becomes described as the philosopher of Protestantism, just as Thomas Aquinas is the philosopher of Roman Catholicism. Well, what kind of faith is it that he's talking about here? It ultimately boils down to a faith that's completely different from what the Bible teaches. It's a faith that's based entirely on man's autonomy within the phenomenal world. Man is the virtual creator of the universe. Within the noumenal world, man imagines himself to be fully autonomous. He imagines himself to be utterly free, to have an autexousion formidable dimensions, to be his own moral legislator. And to believe in God, God is himself only a projection of the autonomous human mind, that the mind sets forth in order to guide it in its own scientific and moral tasks. But this is a powerless God. He's a God who cannot reveal himself authoritatively. He's a God who is not in control of the phenomenal world. He's a God who is at every point dependent upon the autonomous man. There are problems in Kant, that internal problems. Of course, I've shown, I think, that Kant is not a Protestant, that he's inconsistent with the Bible, but there are also problems within Kant's system, problems of internal consistency that have been raised by other philosophers and that have seemed to be very formidable objections to Kant's position. The main problem seems to be it's very important for Kant's philosophy to keep the phenomenal and the noumenal worlds apart, to keep them away from one another. It's very important for Kant to be able to say, look, there is a noumenal world, there is by the way, this other phrase up there, Ding on sich, beside noumenal, I guess I forgot to mention that. That's a German phrase which means thing in itself. The noumenal world consists of things as they really are, things in themselves, the Ding on sich. Well, that's the problem, you see, the Ding on sich. It has to exist, and yet it has to be kept away from our experience. It has to exist, and yet somehow it has to be unknowable. It has to exist, and yet it somehow has to be beyond us. You have to speak of it, and yet, in a sense, you can't really, because you can speak only of the things that you do experience. You see, the problem with the Ding on sich is basically the same problem that Aristotle has with his matter, with his prime matter. You have to talk about the matter. Nevertheless, the matter, by its very nature, is unstructured. It has no nature. It's something that cannot be talked about. It's something that cannot be reasoned about, because if you could reason about it, then it would be form. Well, Kant has the same kind of problem with this Ding on sich. You must speak of it, and yet, on the other hand, how can you speak of it if it has no intelligible nature? How can you speak of it if it's not accessible to experience? How can you speak of it if you don't have any experience of it? If you try to avoid speaking of it, now this would be one answer. Kant might just say, well, let's not speak of it then. Let's quit talking about it. Let's try to be consistent with ourselves. Well, if you don't speak about it, then you're back in rationalism again. Because if you don't speak about it, then the only thing you do speak about is the phenomenal world. And there is no other reality. The phenomenal world is the world. The phenomenal world is the only world. So in knowing the phenomenal world, you know what really is. In knowing the phenomenal world, you know the thing in itself. In knowing the phenomenal world, get rid of all skepticism, and so you're back to continental rationalism again. You lose all the skepticism you had about reality. Well, let's try another possibility to get Kant out of this fix. Let's just keep talking about the Ding on sich. Let's keep mentioning it. Let's say that it exists, and yet yet it's something unknowable. Well, if you keep using that, at least you know that the thing in itself exists. You know that there is such a thing. You know that it exists, and so it's partially knowable. It's in some degree knowable. And if it's partially knowable, why might it not be entirely knowable? So that would get you also back to the old rationalism. But let's say that your basic principle is that you want to avoid rationalism at all costs. Let's assume your basic principle is that you want to remain skeptical about the way things really are. Well, if that's the way you do it, then it seems that your knowledge of the phenomenal world is threatened. Even your knowledge of the phenomenal world is threatened. If you really want to be skeptical, if you really want to disavow all knowledge of the world as it really is, then even your knowledge of the phenomenal world is threatened. Why? Well, after all, consider this possibility. Consider the possibility that the world consists not of water, but of potato chips, to take our illustration about the ice cube trays and so on. It's water, of course, is very malleable. Water very easily takes the form of the thing into which it is poured. But let's say you don't have water, you have potato chips, and you try to put the potato chips into the ice cube tray, and they don't quite fit. You know, you don't get a perfect mesh between the tray and the cubes. They just won't take that shape. Now, to pursue the analogy, not to pursue it, but to give you something more literal, what if experience is like this? What if it's just kind of rough? What if it just doesn't fit into our concepts very well? What if even when we try to investigate experience, even when we try to investigate appearance, even when we try to investigate the phenomenal world, we wind up in paradoxes and contradictions, and nothing seems to go together. Isn't that a possibility? And yet it's a possibility that Kant very arbitrarily ignores. Kant rather naively assumes that whatever the noumenal world is, whatever there is out there, at least it's capable of being experienced, and the experience derivable from it is capable of being analyzed by reason. Now, why is that the case? Or here's another possibility. Maybe some minds are capable of analyzing it and others are not. Maybe some people have the equipment to handle this and other minds don't. And maybe there's no uniformity of human nature. Now, Kant rather naively, I think, assumes a uniformity of human nature at this point. Well, if you try then to be skeptical, if you try to be consistently empirical, if you try to say, look, the knowledge of reality is really beyond us, then it seems to me that that imperils even our knowledge of the phenomenal world. It keeps us from having that sort of exhaustive knowledge of phenomena that Kant himself wanted to have. Now, Kant's own writings, I think, display this problem. In his earlier writings, Kant is somewhat more skeptical. Kant is somewhat more of an empiricist. In his later writings, Kant keeps making all sorts of tentative assertions about the noumenal world. He says all kinds of things about God, about freedom, about immortality. He argues that we have to presuppose these things in order to live and in order to think. He keeps reminding us that these are regulative and not constitutive concepts, but nevertheless, he keeps saying we have to act as if these are true. And as he moves along in his later writings, he puts even more and more emphasis on that. You really have to act as if these are true. Now the problem is, however, if you really have to act as if God exists, well, isn't believing part of living? And if you have to act as if God exists, shouldn't you believe as if God exists? And if you have to believe as if God exists, shouldn't you believe that God exists? And doesn't that do away with the skepticism? So it seems that whatever Kant does, these two elements of his system just work against one another. They can't really be kept together. Now, just before we leave, remember that when you read theology today, this kind of thing is, you run into it all the time. When somebody says that the gospel has to do not with science, that God is not interested in revealing to us scientific assertions or historical assertions, but only assertions about faith, only assertions about the way we should live, only assertions about faith and practice, that kind of thing. When people say that, they're definitely in the Kantian orbit. When people say it doesn't matter whether Jesus was literally raised from the dead or not, what matters is the power of the word as it is preached, that is very definitely a Kantian way of conceiving religion. When people say that God does not reveal himself in propositions, but he reveals himself beyond the realm of reason, beyond the realm of conceptualization, that too is a Kantian kind of statement. So if you keep this structure in mind, you can understand an awful lot of contemporary theology from the time of Kant right on down to the present.